Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is an Our Paranormal Afterlife classic episode, and I'm your host Simon Bowne. I've been thinking about a few standout episodes from the early days of the podcast. They're full of great information, and I thought it would be a good idea to share them again for listeners who may have missed them the first time around. This episode dates back to 2019 and is with Dr. Janice Holden. Now, my guest this week is Dr. Janice Holden. Dr. Holden is a professor at the University of North Texas. For 3 years, she was president of the International Association for Near-Death Studies. She is co-editor of the Handbook of Near-Death Experiences. Well, Jan, thank you very much for coming onto the Past Lives podcast and giving us your time. You wrote that big book, the Handbook of Near-Death Experiences. Can you tell us about that book?
Yes. Well, at the time I was that we were about to celebrate the, I believe it was 50th anniversary, or maybe it was the 40th anniversary. Maybe it was the 30th. It was the 30th anniversary. I have to think back of the publication of Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, in which the phenomenon of near-death experiences, he developed the term near-death experience, and that was the first time that it was used. The phenomenon had been reported previously, even in refereed journal literature, but I think a sequence of circumstances built up to the recognition of this as a thing when in the 20th century resuscitation technology advanced to the point that we were bringing back a lot of people from the brink of death, you know, much more than very unprecedented compared to history. So suddenly, more near-death experiences were being reported, and it was recognized as a thing. So, so in the 30 years since the publication of that book in 1975, we were wanting to do a kind of overview of what research had revealed about near-death experiences, their circumstances, their incidence and prevalence, their contents, their after effects, and then related things like characteristics of near-death experiencers and education about near-death experiences. At that point, there'd been research on all of those things. So we wanted to summarize the research that had been done. So the book consists of a series of chapters on each of those, most of those topics that I've just mentioned. And maybe one of the things that I didn't mention is specifically a chapter on distressing near-death experiences, one on children's near-death experiences, and one on the relationship between near-death experiences and the major texts of the religions of the world. So we wanted to do a kind of a holistic summary. So I was first editor of the book, along with Bruce Grayson, a psychiatrist from the University of Virginia, who I actually consider to be the foremost leading scholar on near-death experiences, and Debbie James, a nurse from Central Texas.
So when people are having a near-death experience, they often report that their perception is much better than real life. And in fact, they say they can see 360 degrees all around them.
Mm-hmm, yes, yes. So the way that I like to define near-death experiences is that they consist, they're typically very lucid experiences. And people talk about having clarity of perception greater than what they have in their physical bodies. And the experience usually consists of sometimes there's a phase, a very brief usually, in which the person just has a very nondescript feeling of absolute peace. And if you ask them was your consciousness in your body or out of your body? They say, I don't know. And just that I was just overwhelmed with this sense of peace. And then typically the person has the aspect that I call the material aspect, because the person is perceiving the material world. And as you said, Simon, they're seeing in ways that are super normal. And this was actually the topic of my doctoral dissertation back in the mid-1980s about the nature of visual perception during the material aspect of the near-death experience. And people say that they see like normal, but better than normal. And so, and they say that like blue still looks like blue. About half of people feel certain that they can read when they're in this out-of-body state, but they also can both see and see through what we consider to be solid objects like ceilings, walls, and people. And they have this 360, it's more than 360, it's spherical vision. So they can see in any direction that they turn their attention. So it's not like we're limited to being able to see only in front of us in our peripheral vision, but imagine being able to also see out of the back of your head, the top of your head, and even below, as if your body weren't there. And people can hear not only the normal things that we hear when we're in our bodies, but also hear people's thoughts. And people have the ability to travel at the speed of thought. So the person might be thinking, this must be, I must be dead, you know, and like, I wonder where my spouse is. And the moment they think of their spouse and wondering where they are, boom, they're there in the presence of their spouse, witnessing whatever their spouse is doing at the time. And so so the person's their sense of their consciousness is usually initially near the physical body, but doesn't always stay there. Senses are both normal and supernormal and very lucid. And I think it's important also to say that the entire experience is people perceive to be absolutely real. In fact, when I was doing my dissertation, this was back in the days before computers, and people would, I would mail them the questionnaire, they'd fill it out and mail it back to me. So I opened up one of these questionnaires and started reading it. And one of the questions I'd asked was, if someone had come to talk with you after your near-death experience to discuss the extent to which it felt real to you, how willing would you have been to talk with them? Because at that time, we didn't even know how willing NDEers were to talk with researchers. And one of the people, instead of actually answering my question, he answered the question of the reality of the experience, and he said, and this is a quote, it's obviously stuck with me for like 40 years. He said, that experience was realer than sitting here writing this response to you. So the experience was realer than real. That's actually a phrase that NDEers often use, that the experience is hyper-real, it's hyper-lucid, and involves both normal and supernormal perception. And then there may be more that you want to ask or say about the material aspect, but there also then is typically in this order, but it can happen in any order, and some NDEs contain one aspect and not the other. Sometimes the aspects can blend with each other, but the other aspect is trans-material. So the person either finds themselves in or experiences a movement to, sometimes through a tunnel or void or other kind of space to a domain that is not of the material world. It's transmaterial, beyond the material world. And it still contains objects and entities, but they mostly are spiritual entities, deceased loved ones, and other beings that that are not of the material world. And sometimes people perceive environments that are like our natural world, but they emphasize that there are colors like they've never seen on Earth. They sometimes hear music like they've never heard on Earth. And so there, again, are these, they're phenomena, but they're not of the material world. But again, feel very real, and people feel this hyper-lucidity.
How much of a person affects their near-death experience? Because so many of them seem tailor-made.
Yeah. In fact, that was one of the early hypotheses, is that the experiences are tailor-made for people. And so one of the analogies that I like to use about near-death experiences is the analogy of the human face. So if you think about the faces of people all around the world, there are certain things that are universal. They've got eyes and nose and mouth, unless they're deformed in some way. You know, the natural order of things is to have eyes, nose, and mouth in a particular configuration with each other. So that's a kind of a universal aspect. Then if you go to racial differences, there are certain features that belong to the Caucasian versus Asian face, for example. And those are analogous to the cultural aspects of near-death experiences. It is unlikely that a person from the U.S., who born and raised in the U.S. has a near-death experience, is going to report seeing a spiritual entity of some indigenous African tribe, because we're just not prepared to see that or to recognize that if we do see it. So there are cultural factors, and we don't know the extent to which culture influences what we experience or just limits the language that we have to describe what we experience in these other states of consciousness and domains of consciousness. And then they're just like if you take any two people from the same race, they're going to be features of their face that are unique to them. And that's the same with near-death experiences. So the universal features are these material and transmaterial aspects, the existence of environments and entities that the person will later report that they encountered during the NDE. And then there will be unique features that one NDEer will report that no other NDEer I've ever known has reported that exact phenomenon or that exact form of a phenomenon. So, culture plays a role, possibly in influencing, maybe more likely in providing us with the language to describe what actually NDEers will say. That, and there's a term in the near-death literature, ineffable, that these experiences are actually at their core ineffable, unable to be described accurately with language, because language was developed to navigate the material world in when our consciousness is in our body. And things happen when consciousness is perceived to have left the body that transcend what language was ever developed to describe. So, culture limits the ways that people can explain what they experienced during their NDEs.
So if we could go back to perception, do you have any examples of people who were blind or deaf from birth, but when they had their NDE, they could see or hear?
Yes, there have been such cases. One is a woman, her name is Vicky, and she was blind from birth. If your listeners are interested, they can search online for a documentary called The Day I Died, The Mind, the Brain, and Near-Death Experiences. And she's featured toward the end of this documentary. It's an hour-long BBC documentary from about maybe 20 years ago now. And she was blind from birth. She says that she has never seen anything. And it had to do, there was nerve damage. And so she said she doesn't see black. She just doesn't see anything. And in her near-death experience, she was out of her body and perceiving in a way that she recognized that what she was, the body that she was looking at lying below unconscious was hers. She could tell that the texture of the hair was like what her hair felt like. And she saw her wedding ring and saw the design on it engraved in it and knew that what she was seeing was what she had felt of her ring. So she recognized that that was her body. Characteristically, she didn't feel particularly connected or at all connected to the body. She recognized that it was hers, but was kind of indifferent to the fact that she was out of it. And so that's an example. And I think your question really is about any evidence that what people are experiencing during their NDEs is verifiable from an objective point of view. So we would look at people who are blind from birth, but who claim to have seen during their NDE, and that what they're describing at least fits the facts that are known at the time. Even more evidential are cases where people have perceived things that, based on the condition and position of their body and anything that they knew at the time, they shouldn't have been able to accurately report, and yet they do. And recently, the International Association for Near-Death Studies published a book titled The Self Does Not Die, and it contains over 100 cases of verified paranormal phenomena associated with near-death experiences, verified by a credible third party, usually the physician who was in attendance at the time. So, for example, a woman is in surgery and she unexpectedly flatlines. Her heart stops, she stops breathing, she's temporarily dead, she's clinically dead for a short period of time. And of course, the surgical team springs into action. They resuscitate her. They complete the surgery and then take her to post-op, where she regains consciousness. Her surgeon comes to check on her and says, you know, how are you doing? And she said, well, I'm fine, but I know that I died during the surgery. And he's like, how do you know that? And she said, well, I was above the ceiling looking down. And then she proceeded to describe everything that each of the people did in the resuscitation process, which amazed him. But then she said, in addition, she said, because I was above the ceiling, I could also see through to the adjacent, amputating a man's leg. And when they finished, they put the amputated leg into a yellow plastic bag to dispose of it. And the physician says, I have no idea what's going on in the other operating rooms of the hospital. And so I didn't have any way of knowing whether she was accurate or not. But he said, I went back to the hospital records and found that indeed at the time that I was doing the surgery on her, they were amputating a man's leg in the adjacent operating room. And he said, because he'd never been in that operating room, it was specialized for amputation, which wasn't his specialization. But he said the room was empty at the time he was looking up the records. So he went and poked his head inside, and there he saw the yellow plastic bags they used to dispose of amputated body parts. So how could this woman know exactly what was happening in the next operating room when the surgeon himself didn't even know what was going on there? So that's one of over 100 cases of verified what's called veridical perception, where the person perceived, if it's apparently non-physical veridical perception, meaning they saw it without any input from the physical senses or from their capacity to infer what might be happening, and then it's verified by a credible third party, that speaks pretty loudly to the objective reality of what people are experiencing, even though most of what people experience in near-death experiences can't be assessed in this way. You know, if somebody says they met their dead grandmother and she told them they had to go back, there's no way to research that. But there are these cases of veridical perception that have been researched.
Despite having all this veridical information and that's coming through from near-death experiences, there are still so many people in the medical profession and, well, just people everywhere that will deny its reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, philosophical materialism, which is the belief that everything is essentially physical, dominates the scientific perspective right now. And the science is not necessarily bound to philosophical materialism, but right now most thinkers are philosophical materialists. And so so many will just dismiss and try to explain away how these things could have happened, but the explanations at some point just become so thin I've never seen an explanation that accounted for everything that happens in a near-death experience. So, and I think an interesting topic in this regard is physicians who have had near-death experiences after they became physicians. And there are several of them now who have published their stories. Probably foremost is Eben Alexander, the former Harvard neurosurgeon, who had his near-death experience in association with meningitis. And he had a form that people rarely survive, and if they do, they rarely survive with their faculties intact. And he survived it and is just as good as before, and he would say better than before. Tony Sicoria had a near-death experience. He is a surgeon, and Mary Neal, also a surgeon. There's an ophthalmologist, I'm blanking on her name right now, but she has a chapter in the book, The Science of Near-Death Experiences, that was recently published by the Missouri Medical Association. And what these people tend to say, and sometimes, and usually pretty adamantly, is that prior to their near-death experience, they were philosophical materialists. They, you know, sort of drank the Kool-Aid of modern scientific perspective, and that has really pervaded medicine as well. And after their near-death experience, they've become philosophical idealists. That is, they now believe that Rather, the materialist view is that consciousness is a product of the brain, that consciousness can be attributed, again, to the physical functioning of the brain. The idealist position is that consciousness and the brain are essentially independent, but very closely associated with each other while we're alive, physically alive. But that consciousness preceded our incarnation. It will exist after our physical bodies and including our brains die. And so I think it's very interesting that a physician who themselves was very steeped in materialist philosophy, once they have this experience, I remember Eben Alexander speaking about this the first time, and he took his thumb and his index finger and put them just a little bit apart. And he said, you know, I used to think that I knew as a Harvard neurosurgeon, I used to think I knew pretty much everything there was to know about consciousness. Since my near-death experience, I take all that information, and that's when he put his index finger and thumb really close together. And he said, it's that much information in a vast universe of consciousness. And so he essentially said that he was mistaken. He thought he was right, but he was wrong, thinking that materialism was it.
So some people have distressing near-death experiences. Would you be able to give us an overview of them?
Sure. Well, the people who've researched this the most are Nancy Evans Bush and Bruce Grayson and a physician from Florida whose name I maybe will remember in just a moment. She has passed herself. And especially Nancy and Bruce have found is that distressing experiences tend, first of all, let me back up and say something about who has near-death experiences. And the best answer from research is we don't know. What we know is that of all the people who survive a close brush with death, about 1 in 5 will report a near-death experience. And we don't know, we in research, we haven't been able to distinguish between people who do and don't recall NDEs. The circumstances of their death seem similar, if in fact indistinguishable. And why one person has an NDE and the other doesn't, we just don't know. Then of all those people who've had a near-death experience, perhaps 1 in 10, maybe 1 in 20, reports a distressing experience dominated by feelings of terror, horror, or guilt, whereas the vast majority of people, 80 to 90%, report experiences dominated by peace, joy, bliss, and pleasurable emotions. So going back to those people who report distressing NDEs, their experiences seem to take one of three forms. And the most common is that their experience has all the same features as a pleasurable NDE. It might have the material aspect, the transmaterial aspect, the elements of the experience are very much the same. But somehow they're experiencing it negatively. They're distressed. Resistance seems to be a common theme that, you know, I'm moving rapidly through a tunnel toward a light, but I don't want to be moving rapidly through a tunnel toward a light. So it's like I'm digging in my heels, and that resistance seems to be creating negative affect. But other than that, there's no difference. And one of the things that has been a theme that has occurred in some NDEs of that type is that once the person decides to surrender and just accept the experience, it turns pleasurable. So this, the most commonly described form of distressing experience, seems to be have a lot to do with the person's own readiness and willingness to allow the experience to unfold. Next most commonly reported is an experience of the void, in which the person has a sense of being absolutely alone forever and hyper aware of their absolute isolation. And so so that's another form, and I'll come back to that in just a minute. And then the least reported of distressing experiences involves some kind of torment, where the person either themselves feels tormented or witnesses other spiritual entities being tormented in some way. And even this one, it's different than what some people might think, in fundamentalist Christian religion, there's the saying hellfire and brimstone. But actually, that's not what people experience. I think a good example is Matthew Devel. He, in his second near-death experience, let me just say he had a first near-death experience when he was a young teenager or preteen, trying to show off swimming in a pool, and he drowned. And he had a conversation with Jesus in which Jesus told him that he had to go back because he had work to do. And so he was rescued from the pool and resuscitated, of course, and very confused about how to make sense of what he'd experienced. And it was at a time before NDEs were very well known. Well, one of the things that happened to him, which often happens to NDEers, is he had after effects that were very overwhelming, and to like extreme empathic sensitivity. He just couldn't be around other people without feeling what they were feeling. And imagine being in junior high school and having that kind of sensitivity. It was just overwhelming. And so he turned to drugs as a way to sort of deaden his hypersensitivity and other after effects. And he didn't have anybody to talk about with it and so forth. So he just used what he could to try to manage it. He developed a very bad drug habit. And by the time he was in his early 20s, he perceived himself to just be a burden to his family. So he decided to kill himself. And in his near-death experience, among other things, he felt himself free-falling, and he hit this surface that he said was sort of like a tennis court clay surface and split into three hymns, three Matthews. And one Matthew was over on the side, lying prostrate and weeping because of what the other two Matthews were experiencing. And the second Matthew was experiencing encounters with people from his lifetime who he had hurt in some way. And the person would come up, one person at a time would appear, would come toward him and sort of bump chests with him. And when they did, he would re-experience the situation from his life and experience being on the receiving end of his actions. So he was feeling all the pain that he had engendered in other people. And the other him was experiencing pain that people would feel in the future as a result of his decisions, including his decision to kill himself. And so he said that this went on nonstop for 3 days and three nights, just people and situations coming up and And this the Matthew that was weeping at one point after these 3 days and three nights called out to Jesus to help him. And he said that it's like the sort of like the sky opened up and this hand came down and lifted him off the surface. And when it did, the three Matthews went back into one and this hand pulled him out. And then he had another encounter with Jesus and another conversation about him going back because he had work to do. And this time, as an adult, he was more prepared to make sense of that. And from that point on, he has never used a drug, and he heads up a nonprofit foundation for suicide prevention. So he's an example that is often the case with distressing NDEs, that the person either perceives the NDE or uses it as a kind of course correction in their life. And the same is true with the void experience. The first person I heard who described that was at the time that I met him, it was a few years after his NDE. And he said that when he was growing up, he grew up in a very abusive home. And the way that he survived was by making himself as invisible as possible, because if they don't notice you, then they can't beat up on you. And he used that mode of operation in his life going all the way into adulthood. He, at the time, was employed in a job where he worked alone in his own studio and just had as little to do with people as possible. And then he got to be 30 and something happened. I don't remember what the medical crisis was, but he died temporarily physically, and during which he had this NDE in which he was out in the void, absolutely alone forever and hyper aware that this was his existence. It was an existence of absolute eternal isolation. And after he was resuscitated and reflected on it, he realized that what he had gotten in his NDE was what he had decided in life that he wanted, which was to be left absolutely alone. But in physical existence, we never can get that because inevitably, you know, there are other people around. In this experience, he got it. And only in getting it did he realize that that was not really what he wanted. What he wanted was safe connection with people. And so he then went about redesigning his whole life and learning how to discern people who were relatively more trustworthy and how to cultivate intimacy with people and things that had just never been part of his life prior to his NDE. So one of the books about distressing NDEs by Barbara, and now her last name starts with R, it's called Blessings in Disguise, because so many, not all, but a good number of distressing NDEs, people either perceive to have been or use as a course correction in their lives. So I tend to think, now, what I'm about to say is not research-based. This is my opinion. My opinion is that people get the NDE that they need for their development. And the reason some people don't get an NDE when they're temporarily dead or at least in a close, because you don't have to actually be physically dead. You can be in a close brush with death without an actual injury, like fearing death. But that people get, some people don't have a near-death experience because they don't need it, or they might not be receptive to anything. You know, I don't pretend to know the higher wisdom that's at work, but there does appear to be some wisdom at work about designing an NDE that fits what a person needs for their own psycho-spiritual development.
So if we could go back a little bit there, you were talking about how Matt that was split into three, and he had a meeting with Jesus. Just from your opinion, do you think that was actually Jesus, or it was something else representing themselves like that because that's what he needed?
Well, I don't pretend to even have an opinion about that, because that's one of the aspects of the experience that just can't be researched. What I can tell you is that people feel absolutely certain. Now, sometimes a person will say, I saw this entity, I think it was Jesus, or I'm going to say that was Jesus. Sometimes they say, I met Jesus. Sometimes the entity introduces himself as Jesus. And of course, he's not the only spiritual entity that people see. But now the other side of it is, I did a little study one time, a little informal study, using near-death experiences from the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation website, NDERF.org. There are thousands of NDEs registered on this website. And I searched for ones in which the person mentioned Jesus and described what Jesus looked like. And what I can tell you is that I don't know if Jesus like uses contact lenses to change the color of his eyes, but some people said he had blue eyes. Some said he had brown eyes. Some said he had eyes that were just light, that emanated light. Some people said his hair was brown. Some said it was golden. Some said he was tall. Some said he was normal height. And some said that his voice was soft like music, and another person said it was as loud as a locomotive. So there were two people who didn't know each other from Adam, who said in a little different way, of course, it's always unique to each person, but essentially they were told in their NDE, you're about to meet Jesus. How would you like him to appear? And so the implication is that phenomena appear in the way that we are most ready to accept them, without, so that we can like not be distracted by, wait a minute, you've got brown hair, I thought you had golden hair. So we can get to the chase, which is, you know, cut to the chase, which is the message of the encounter. And that message, near-death experiencers say, is about love and about knowing that what we do to other people, we really do to ourselves, that literally in our near-death experiences, we are the people with whom we interacted, and we experience being on the receiving end of our own actions. And that that people, even though they review these things in their near-death experiences, usually in the presence of some spiritual entity, which most people refer to as like a being of light. It's light, but it's a being that emanates absolute love. All knowing, the person feels absolutely known in every way and absolutely loved. So even the things that they themselves did in their lifetime that was not loving is, many NDEers say it isn't even a matter of forgiveness, because it's just not perceived as wrong, as much as that, just that the person realizes by experiencing, you know, being on the receiving end, that this is something they just don't want to do anymore. They don't want to hurt other people because they realize they're hurting themselves in the process. So So to go back to your question, you know, what do people really encounter Jesus? I think that people, we're into the domain of opinion now. I think that people perceive what they perceive in a way that they're most prepared to perceive it, so that they're not distracted by the form and they can focus on the content, the message, the meaning in the encounter.
Could you tell us how children's NDEs differ from adults?
Well, they're quite similar. And the big difference is that they can be simpler, and in the way that even children's dreams are simpler than adults' dreams. And so so there may be somewhat less detail. And again, that may actually relate more to the child's limited way of describing what they experienced. But they really have all the same features, a material aspect, a transmaterial aspect, meeting deceased loved ones, meeting spiritual entities, going to these preternatural environments that are just full of color and life. And you know, the material aspect of seeing their body from a position outside of it, and knowing what their parents are doing at the time that they're that the child is in the near-death state. So it's really quite similar. Just maybe either the experience or the description of it is maybe simpler than that of an adult.
So when people come back from NDEs, over time, there's all sorts of after effects, aren't they? Psychological and physical?
Right, right, yes. I like to categorize them as PSPS, you know, like PS is after something you say after a letter. So the first P is psychological. And this is where person, first of all, the single biggest thing that happens for people after an NDE is that they lose their fear of death. They do not fear death. Some people, because the experience was so profoundly pleasurable, they really welcome death, but they also don't seek death, because they also learn that their life has meaning, that our lives on earth, we're here for reasons, and we're not meant to shorten our stay here unnaturally. At the same time, that suicide is not, people who've had suicide NDEs have not felt punished for attempting suicide. It's more that they realized that they had made a big mistake because their life had purpose. And so the people who have attempted rarely attempt suicide again if they had an NDE previously. So the loss of fear of death is the really biggest psychological change, but also people's values change. They become less materialistic, more concerned about others, more empathic to what other people are experiencing, and have more of a sense of appreciation of life and pursuit of meaning in life, having a sense that there is meaning in life. And I'm trying to think of other, those are some of the main psychological changes. Then the next letter is S for spiritual. And here people become more spiritually oriented, typically. Probably more people who've had NDEs leave organized religion, but it's because they have an ongoing connection with this spiritual domain that they that they experienced and know to be different than what is represented in religion. So they find religion, organized religion, to be too confining. And so at the same time that they become more spiritual, they may become less religious. But there are some NDEers who actually devote themselves even more to their organized religion. So it isn't just one way. But either way, it's out of a sense of deepened spirituality, an ongoing sense of connectedness to the spiritual domain and entities that they encountered in their NDEs, pursuit of information about spiritual matters, pursuing things like yoga and Reiki and things of a spiritual nature like that. And also what I put in the spiritual domain are like paranormal abilities. So people often become more psychic, may have precognition, knowing the future, telepathy, knowing what other people are experiencing. Or one person described it as, when I meet somebody, I see a little film of their past and I just know things about them from their past. Clairvoyance, seeing scenes at a distance. So these kind of paranormal ESP kinds of abilities. One NDEer I know has developed psychokinesis. She can move a pinwheel just by moving her hand around it, but a few inches away from it. And then she can reverse it by moving her hand in the other direction. And she's been studied at three different laboratories, including Stanford, to verify that there's nothing, you know, she's not faking this in any way. She really has this ability. And that's related to the next one, which is the next letter is again a P, and that's for physical. And people feel different physically. For one thing, they sometimes don't feel like they're completely inside their body anymore. And that can be disorienting. But they often report being more sensitive to medication, to allergens. They may need less sleep. They may change their diet, perhaps eliminating meat. But on the other hand, I have a good friend, NDEer, who has to have meat every day or she doesn't feel right. So again, it's personalized and there's some tendencies, but there are very few things that you can say are true of every near-death experiencer. And then the electrical after effects it's in the physical category where, especially when the person is emotionally aroused in some way, whether it's elated or grief stricken or terrified or horrified or angry, emotional arousal. The electrical things around them malfunction. And so, and they don't have to be emotionally aroused, but it's the effect is exacerbated when they're emotionally aroused. And so, like I interviewed an NDEer who, she and her boyfriend lived together and they had bought a new TV about 3 months before our interview. And she was saying that when I mentioned electromagnetic after effects, she hadn't put two and two together that that's what she'd been experiencing, that it was due to her near-death experience. But she said, that explains everything. Ever since we got this new TV, my boyfriend complains that whenever I'm in the room, that's when the volume goes up and down and the channels switch and nobody's touching the remote control. Nobody's doing anything. And he complains that it only happens when I'm in the room. And so she's having that effect on the TV. So So that's the P for physical. And then the last S is social. So the psychological, spiritual, and physical changes, the person is often different than they were prior to their NDE. Not that they still identify as the same identity, but a transformed identity. And so it has repercussions in their social lives. People change careers toward more service-oriented careers. A lot of people go into ministry, health services, become counselors, work in hospice and things like that. And we know that if a person is married at the time of their NDE, they're at higher risk for divorce than the general population. And we also know that the reason has to do, it harkens back to those psychological changes, the value changes, that when before the NDE, usually the two people's values were, you know, compatible. And then the person has an NDE and their values diverge, becoming less materialistic and so forth. So when that happens, the couple are likely to divorce. And there are a couple of cases in the research that my former doctoral student, now Dr. Roseanne Christian, did, where the people reported that after the NDE, their marriage was better than ever. And it was because the other spouse actually started off with more NDE-like values. So when the person, the other spouse had the NDE, their values converged with their spouse, and their marriage continued, and they had better than they considered their marriage to be better than before. So it all has to do with whether the values that the person, that the NDEer manifests after the NDE, diverge or converge with the values of their spouse that seem to influence whether the marriage will end in divorce or will continue.
So are there practical applications that come from studying near-death experiences?
Yes. And some of the implications have to do with helping people become, well, first of all, experiencing relief from grief. I actually had another doctoral student, Ryan Foster, who did his dissertation studying the effect of information about near-death experiences on grief. And what he found was that when people who were grieving learned about near-death experiences, their grief symptoms significantly improved. So there's something about, in my thinking, grief involves three questions. One is, where and how is the deceased person? Another is, how am I supposed to go on in life without them? And a third is, what's our relationship now? Will we ever be together again? And can I still communicate with this person? And so near-death experiences answer at least the first question, which is that if the majority of people have pleasurable experiences, it's likely that the deceased is in a state of bliss, continuing to exist somewhere in a state of bliss. So that's very comforting to people. And I've just known a lot of people who came into the study of near-death experiences because of the loss of a loved one to death. Another is that research indicates that when people who have not had NDEs themselves learn about them, they manifest some of the same changes. They reduce their fear of death. They feel more of a sense of purpose and meaning in life. They become more concerned about others, more empathic, more oriented towards service to people and the planet, and so forth. So that's those are obviously very valuable potential outcomes. And then there are some more sort of specialized applications, which are that I've done research showing that near-death experiencers who disclose their NDEs to healthcare providers, medical, psychological, spiritual, and so forth, healthcare providers, about one in five of those encounters, the NDE are considered to have been harmful because the healthcare provider either denied the potential reality of the experience or pathologize the experience or the experiencer, thinking that the person or the experience was crazy, which research absolutely does not support that conclusion. But again, you know, in their misinformation or lack of information, people sometimes make that, draw that conclusion. Or they may have demonized the experience and considered it to have been evil or of the devil. And those kinds of reactions by healthcare providers actually harm people, despite the fact that all healthcare providers' first ethic is to do no harm. And so, one of the practical things that needs to happen is education of healthcare providers, so that they do acknowledge and affirm NDEs as a known thing, that they're not related to mental illness, that they yield what in the Bible are called the fruit of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. So it is not appropriate to demonize them. And in that way, avoid doing harm to NDEers. So those are a few of the practical considerations. And let me say, too, that I think probably the biggest thing is to inspire people to reflect on who they really are. It is easy to conclude that I am this body at this time, and that when my body dies, I'm just gonna, I don't know, annihilate in some way. But if we take near-death experiences seriously, they point to our being eternal consciousness that does not annihilate at physical death. And it puts a new light on life and purpose, the purpose of life. And I have a colleague in Iran who is a scholar of near-death experiences. And we often commiserate that if everyone lived according to what is known from near-death experiences, the world would be a very different place, much more compassionate and joyful.
Yes. Yeah. That's one of the reasons I like to do the podcast and get this information out there, is it can be so positive when people learn about these things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's been fantastic having you as a guest on the Past Lives podcast. It's so interesting to talk to you.
Well, great. I've really enjoyed it, Simon. You've just let me talk and talk and talk, and I really appreciate the opportunity to put out all the things that I've accumulated over the past few decades. So thank you for that opportunity.
And the book, The Handbook of Near-Death Experiences, can people get that still? Is that on Amazon?
Yes, it can be purchased. And since you've said that, let me plug another couple of books. One I mentioned before, The Self Does Not Die, which is those cases of verified paranormal phenomena associated with NDEs. And another is a book called Connecting Soul, Spirit, Mind, and Body, which is available online. It can be read, it can be purchased, but it also can be read for free online. And I have a chapter in there on near-death experiences. So if people want to be pointed to further reading or viewing, there are some recommended resources there. And let me throw in one other thing that I realized yesterday. I was looking at the chapter that I had neglected to include reference to a video that can be purchased for healthcare providers called Near-Death Experiences, What Medical Professionals Need to Know. And that can be purchased from the website of the International Association for Near-Death Studies, IANDS.org, which also is a tremendous resource for people wanting to learn about near-death experiences.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you very much for that.
You bet.
And thank you for being a guest on the podcast.
Thank you, Simon.
And that was an interview with Dr. Janice Holden. A great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon. For $6 a month, you get an extended episode every week. For $3 a month, you get an extended episode every month. These exclusive Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.